Welcome, dear listener, to Let's Dig Deeper, the podcast where we talk all about archaeology, history, art, and culture. My name is Zinat Haroun, and I am a student of classical archaeology here at the University of Copenhagen, and in this podcast, I'm going to take you along for interviews with some of the delightful people working in the field. And we'll talk with archaeologists, historians, and professionals. Hopefully, we'll learn more about the past in the process. Today, I'm joined by not one, but two wonderful guests, Rebecca Bristov and Mikkel Nørtoft, and welcome to the studio, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Rebecca, you graduated from Paris Pantheon Sorbonne University with a master's in prehistoric archaeology, and you're currently doing your PhD here at the University of Copenhagen. You also have a degree in digital humanities, which we'll be talking more about today. And Mikkel, you have a PhD in prehistoric archaeology from here at UCPH, and you're currently on your postdoc, where you're also partially stationed in Kiel in Germany. And you've researched prehistoric migrations, and you also have a background working on archaeolinguistics. And today's episode is all about AI and archaeology, the archaic contra the ultra-modern, and I think we're in for a hell of a ride. And now, before we fully begin, I'd love it if we could just first get an idea of what AI really is. I mean, I'm sure that most everyone listening to this has by now heard of ChatGPT and the dangers of AI, but if we cut to the bone, how can we define AI, Rebecca?
Yes, so in very simple terms, AI is a system that imitates human abilities. So that is, for example, learning from data, from information. It is recognizing patterns in that information. It is also processing language, so being able to understand language and to communicate in that language. And most importantly, it is able to predict, to make predictions and decisions. So that would be a very simple way of defining it.
No, I think that's great, because sometimes we end up overcomplicating it and making ourselves even more confused, right? But Mikkel, when we connect AI and archaeology, we create a really interesting mix. Is there a relevant connection to be made between these two things?
Yes, I think so, because archaeology produces a lot of vast amounts of data, and that's kind of ideal to work on with AI. So I think that's kind of almost a perfect
example. It's a great fit.
Example. Yeah.
All right. And to learn more about all this, let's dig deeper. To start us off, can you each share an example of how AI has been used in archaeology, whether that be classical or prehistoric? Rebecca, will you start?
Yeah, there's one project that I think is very cool. It is from this company called Iconem or Iconem that is working with what is called digital archiving. So, for example, there is this ancient city in Palmyra in Syria that was destroyed by ISIS in 2015. And so this company got drones to take pictures of the area and used AI to reconstruct it digitally using 3D modeling. So this is a really great way to preserve sites that might be threatened by war or conflict or even natural decay. So I think that is a very promising way of using AI.
Yeah, for sure. Do you think of another?
Yeah, so there's a lot of studies that use AI to look at satellite images, for example, or even historical maps to identify sites or features. So like grave mounds on historical maps, then they train them on the signatures and then they can like mass identify them.
Yeah.
So that's quite exciting. I think it's happening both in Jutland, I think they have an element of this, and also in Schleswig-Holstein.
Both some elements of, you know, preservation in yours and then also identification as well, right? Yeah. Okay. Well, now I'm not a complete stranger to AI myself, and I have sometimes used it as a student, but I'm very far from being an expert. And I do know that there are different types of AI, like generative AI and large language models. Mikkel, can you maybe give a short introduction in super simple terms to the different types of AI and how archaeologists might be working with them?
I can try at least. It's a huge field, of course, but I use it as well. But there's something called symbolic AI, which is, I think some call it good old-fashioned AI. It's more rule-based, simple sort of, various types of knowledge that you can use to calculate things and so on. And it's actually often more explainable and more reproducible and transparent and predictable, but it's just more limited in what it can do. It can only do what you gave it, sort of, what you taught it. And then you have more sort of the generative AI, which is kind of taking over the world at the in some ways, at least. Which is training, for example, a language model on all the text you can find on the internet and just making it sort of figure it out and find its own patterns from that. And from that, it can sort of interpolate in between also what you didn't give it. So that can be really good if it's a creative situation, but if you want something very strict or fact-based, it can actually be what we call hallucination. So it produces completely new stuff from this.
can I add? I think also when we talk about what is AI, what types of AI, we have a lot of keywords in mind that are kind of flying around, like deep learning, machine learning, generative AI. There's so many keywords.
Yeah.
So maybe also to make it simple, machine learning is the way you train the AI to learn from a data set and to make prediction. That is very simply what machine learning is. And then there is a much more complex version of machine learning, which is deep learning. And within that is generative AI. But it is all kind of a bit like Russian dolls, basically.
Yeah, so it's like one inside of the other.
Yeah,
it just
pretty
continues
much,
all the way through. All right. And when did archaeologists first start experimenting seriously with AI? I mean, is this a new as development as it's being made out to be, or does it have earlier roots?
You know, I had to look this up, actually. I was curious about that. So archaeologists are always really good at being ahead of the wave, if you can say that, like being very nerdy and using all the new technologies. So we have started using AI since the 70s.
Wow.
But I would say that was probably quite experimental. And it seems AI really took a bit of a turn with the appearance of what we call geographic information systems.
Yes, GIS, right?
GIS,
I remember from the course.
Yeah, exactly. So what allows us to make maps, to make spatial analysis. So in that case, AI has been very useful because it's like Mikkel was saying, it was useful to predict where potential sites were. So I would say, since the 90s, it kind of started growing. And then, of course, the last decades have been very dynamic in terms of especially generative AI.
Yeah, and early on more in this sort of more traditional machine learning type where now the whole generative wave is being used more and more.
Yeah, so it's sort of gone from this very only the nerds know it to now it's more like a commonplace thing,
yes.
Right? It's
yeah.
almost like most everyone in society has like some level of idea of what it's about or has at least heard the term, which is more than you could have said, at least in the 70s, I imagine.
And there is more training now also, right? Archaeologists like PhDs like us can follow courses. So that is quite new, yeah.
And also on conferences, you can really see the difference. Most big conferences in archaeology now have element of maybe a session about AI or maybe more of them, where this would not, you wouldn't see that very much before.
Yeah, it's taking up more space, right?
Yeah.
And one of the more positive aspects to AI is how it can complement or even vastly improve on human work. And are there any surprising discoveries in archaeology that have been made possible by AI that we might otherwise not have found via traditional methods?
There was a study looking at geoglyphs in Peru where they used a lot of, I don't remember if it was satellite or aerial images.
I think it was satellite, yeah.
Where they found like a lot of new, like I think maybe 300 new of these weird geoglyphs, like drawings in the ground.
And geoglyphs are these mounds, sort of, right?
It's more where like drawings, I think.
Shapes.
I'm not an expert in this at all.
In southern, I looked it up. in southern Peru, they made these like gigantic drawings of creatures. And the way they did it is because it's a desert, right?
Yeah.
So they moved like the pebbles and this reveals the white sand underneath. Mm. And so it creates these massive drawings that you can see from like a helicopter.
Okay.
It's very cool.
It's very cool, yeah. So that's quite huge, I would say.
Yeah, and that's something we otherwise never would have even noticed by ourselves, right?
Yeah. And you mentioned at some point also the scrolls.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's one that I find really cool. So there's this ancient city, Roman city of, I'm not sure how you pronounce it in English, Herculaneum?
Yeah, Herculaneum, yeah.
Yeah, that is right next to Pompeii that you might have heard was covered in ashes by a volcano eruption. So Herculaneum was the same. And this means that we found a lot of scrolls there that were covered in ash and they were also closed, right? So there was no real way of manually just opening them and reading them. So they used AI in order to 3D scan them, to open them digitally and then read them. So that's very cool and not something we would have been able to do ourselves.
Yeah, I've actually seen that. That's information that otherwise would have been completely lost, right?
Yeah.
If a human tried to open it manually, it would crumble.
Yeah,
exactly. So being able to scan it like that unveils a lot of information. And Rebecca, from a digital humanities perspective, how do you see AI reshaping the way we approach archaeological research? I mean, we'd already talked a little bit about the possibilities, but what changes is AI making to the humanities as a field?
Yeah, that is a huge question. I think also because maybe there is a difference between field archaeology and archaeology research also, there might be different answers for these two types. So because for field archaeology, I don't think it will necessarily reshape archaeology because our job is basically to learn from the past by excavating and analyzing. And whatever the tools are, this is still the core of the discipline, right? So I do think it will definitely accelerate research, make everything a bit faster and easier. But I don't think it will necessarily change the core of what is archaeology. But then there's the question of research. And if AI can start creating research questions, that is a big topic. And this I'm not sure at all for now. I don't think right now it isn't really very interesting, the potential research questions that AI can come up with. Mm. But who knows in the next 10 years? Maybe, Mikkel, you have an idea about that. But
yeah, so, and also on the excavation part, I think that at least on the documentation of excavations part, there's a study right now, or a project, a huge project, I think ERC, so European Commission in Italy right now, I think it's the MAPA Lab. They do many interesting technical things, but they have now a project called Automata, which is supposed to try and make a robot that actually automatically documents excavation materials, both in laser scanning, I think photogrammetry, and probably also taking, I think, measurements of everything automatically and standardized. Mm-hmm. So I think that is very close to the excavation, not exactly digging it up, but
it's complementary, right?
So yeah. Very complementary and could at least make a huge amount of really good quality excavation data.
Yeah, less human error.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
for sure.
But then for the research, I think I found this paper also reading a little bit up for this podcast today. So
I'm glad you're prepared.
Yeah, we try a little bit. Yeah, right? But I think it was called IARC, where they actually try to have some sort of model. And if I understood it correctly, you can throw a lot of different kinds of data at it, climate, grave, settlements, and then actually see if it can form some hypotheses perhaps from that. So let's see if it will be interesting in the future. But I think there are some things happening in that space even.
So AI, when used as a tool, can actually be pretty helpful in freeing up space that researchers could otherwise use on very time-consuming tasks, right? Instead allowing them to work on more meaningful stuff. And that's a positive thing, right?
Definitely.
Yeah.
And since it seems that AI is clearly here to stay, how do you think it will shape the humanities in the long run? What will our definition of expertise be in 10 or 20 years when things that have otherwise taken so much time to perfect now become something that is easily automated?
Yeah, I can try and give a shot at that. It's hard to predict the future, of course, but I think the critical skills, source criticism and all that stuff that we learn in the humanities, of course, is going to be really, really important, because you get so much information now from, you have the internet before, but now you also have this extra AI layer which just generates more and more information in insane amounts. So you need to be able to really filter through all that and see what's good or bad, true or not true. So I think that ability is extremely important. And then being able to take your like combined theoretical models and so on with digital skills, I think is going to be a very important thing as well. And I think a lot of traditional archaeologists can actually use AI a lot to learn new, more technical skills much easier.
Yeah. And it does help us also, yeah, define what it is to be a researcher. And I totally agree about that we are so critical and that our purpose is to interpret but critically data. That is very interesting. I think a lot of people are scared that AI is going to take over, but in that way, I think we're pretty safe as researchers because our core work is to be critical about our sources.
Yeah, and perhaps that part of the human mind can't really be easily replicated. At least not yet.
Yeah, let's see. Yeah, but not yet. Not yet. And I also think just breaking down the disciplinary barriers, because it can help you now to read any paper, basically, and understand, at least to get a grasp of it, right?
Also something I was thinking, I hope it's not a total tangent, but I was thinking of also the fact that a lot of our research and our conversations happen in the workplace, in the office or in conferences, are not necessarily published, or they end up published eventually. But I think that's also interesting that AI doesn't really have access to that very new knowledge, right? It usually has to sort of use already published sources or stuff that is available, right? So I was thinking about that maybe also AI is a bit late sometimes.
Yeah, there's a delay maybe, right?
There might be a little delay, yeah.
True.
And, you know, through many years of AI usage, there's been this concept of the black box problem. And this is partly about inaccessible data and stuff like that. Can you explain what the black box problem is? And is it relevant for archaeological research as well, where we often already have fragmentary information?
So this is a problem with transparency of our methods if we use AI, because we consider archaeology to be a science, right? So we have to have a methodology that is very transparent, very clear and systematic. And so when we excavate, you know, everything is very well labeled. labeled, everything is classified, and there's really this process. Using AI kind of hides this process. So I mentioned deep learning before. So when it's very complex, so like deep learning, when it's very complex AI, it makes a lot of decisions to reach a certain prediction, right, or decision. It makes thousands and thousands of these tiny little decisions, and it's very difficult to go in the black box and figure out how it reached a certain point. So this means scientifically it's very problematic, because the whole point of our research is to be reproducible for others, to know what process we went through. So that would be a problem. Also because our data is very fragmentary, it's not necessarily complete. So this may lead to interpretations that are not really accurate. So, yeah.
Have there been any attempts to sort of get around this problem? Or
I think it's very difficult. There was just a conference in Kiel recently, and we had an AI session there as well. And there's also some really big projects that throw a lot of data into this and so on. And they also got this question, and it was a little bit uncertain how much they could actually be certain how the result would be produced, or if anything, if everything would be explainable in the same way. And I think it will come. And I think there are some studies that try to implement sort of some decision trees or things like that for the AI to sort of be able to better show how it reasoned about something, or how it came to some conclusion, or what it was doing in the meantime. But it's still a little bit tricky if you like do the thing where you just throw a bunch of data into a big black box, right? And something comes out at the end.
But then you can use smaller models, right? You can use customized models, and that would allow to actually know exactly how the model is going.
To
track it.
Yeah, and then at least if you do a custom model, you at least know what data you put into it, right?
Exactly.
So I think it's very important that you understand the data you give it, because then you better would understand the results or the output.
But also, as you say, Rebecca, one of the purposes is to sort of share the research that we do, right? And if you share it, but the steps in between are sort of veiled in mystery, other researchers can't very well verify that what you've said or what you are presenting to them is even true, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
And there are also other issues in using AI, like the new tech's environmental impact. It's said quite often that one ChatGPT inquiry requires as much energy as 10 Google searches or something like that. Something that quite naturally has an effect on our climate, considering the amount of electricity that has to be produced for these tools. But is sustainability something that we as archaeologists should also consider when working with AI tools?
Yes.
Please, yes.
I think anyone using these AI tools should think about this and try to somehow see if they use it, can they do something else in their life that's not as like maybe less consumerism, less fast fashion, maybe eating less meat or flying less, or anything you can think of that would sort of balance it out a little bit,
sort of, because
it's all the same sort of energy use that we use, like, all together, right? But also you can just try to use smaller models. If you have a simple question, many of the models today have a way you can choose a mini version of it. There's many lightweight versions of the big models, and you can do it locally with open source, where you can run it locally on your own computer. You don't need a big data center.
Yeah. And in general, just also being critical of the use of AI, do you really need to use AI? It's very trendy at the moment, but do you need to adapt the project to the tool or the tool to the project? Sometimes you need to think about, does my project really require AI at all?
And beyond the practical, in air quotes, restrictions of AI, there are also some more ethical considerations to be made. I mean, what are some of the ethical dilemmas that we can run into when we're using AI as a tool in archaeology?
Yeah, the copyright, of course, because many of these big models were trained on copyrighted material without permission. That's a really big problem, I would say. And it's kind of an original sin, you could call it, for all these big models that we cannot really take out of it anymore. It has happened already, and we can't really fix it. I wished that these models would also, if you generate especially creative stuff, if you put in like, I want an image in the style of Van Gogh, or maybe not Van Gogh, maybe someone living, right? They would actually maybe pay some royalty to that artist. Would have been great if it had some mechanism like that. Like if you do streaming on Spotify, which is a bad example, they do really bad payments to the artists. But I don't know if it's technically impossible or why it has not happened, but I have not seen it anywhere. That could have actually diminished a lot of this big copyright problem, I think.
Yeah, because I've heard a lot of artists really be very upset about the way AI is using their work and not allowing them to actually profit off of their own work, but giving that opportunity to everyone who is then illegally actually using their work, right?
Yeah.
Also, something that I find a little scary is who owns the results that AI comes up with, the interpretations, who owns them? Because is it the researcher that owns them? Because they're the ones who have maybe given the data to the AI, but maybe the model belongs to a specific company. So does the company own these results? I think that's also a pretty scary question for researchers.
There's been some legal actions on this, I think, and if I remember correctly, and I think they decided that kind of nobody owns it really, or like it depending on what it is, I think. But I think you are responsible for the output, no matter what it is, and therefore you can say that you own it, but you also own the responsibility, right?
Yeah.
At least you cannot give any responsibility to an AI model.
No, so you get
basically
both of those things, right?
Because that you could say, well, it was ChatGPT who told me, but that's on you that you used it.
Okay. But it is really, really new ground that we're covering as well, right? So that's also why there haven't been made these regulations yet, because lawmakers can't really keep up with every time they actually then regulate something, then suddenly there are 10 new things they sort of have to decide on.
Yeah.
So it's sort of this never-ending race against technology. And maybe that's where the human ability sort of comes to a short stop, right? We can't keep up with how fast it goes.
Definitely.
And on the topic of transparency, there is also the question of whether we can truly trust the output that AI gives us. I mean, we've already talked a little bit about that. But I mean, even on a student level, there have been times when I've had to correct ChatGPT and be like, actually, that's not true. The information you're giving me is something I know for a fact is incorrect. Mm. And in that case, more often than not, it will just say, oh, you're right, let me correct that. And that just puts a doubt on the user then, right? Because how will you then be able to tell that what it's next telling you is correct? And how can we know what's true? And how can we distinguish and trust the facts that are presented to us?
I mean, they say AI is only as good as the data you give it. So if the data is not complete, then the AI will not be very accurate. For example, actually, if you ask ChatGPT right now about very specific topics that I'm studying, for example, about the Neolithic, like very, very specific, it will make lots of mistakes because it just doesn't have access to the data.
It fills the gaps, basically.
It fills the gaps.
It just imagines, hallucinates, as
exactly.
you said, right?
Yeah. We had a recent example recently where we tested it out down in Kiel, and a colleague of mine, she didn't really trust the response coming out. And also, I was like, I'm not sure. I think that date is wrong on that cave painting or whatever he's talking about. And then we actually looked it up, and it was correct.
Okay.
So it was just that we actually remembered wrong.
Yeah.
So we also have that ability, of course, to hallucinate a little bit, right?
Yeah.
But it's definitely a thing. And something like RAG can help a lot, giving it specific knowledge. Maybe it could be a bunch of PDFs or whatever you want to interrogate the language model on. That can help a lot.
Yeah, so predetermined and already sort of like sifted through and fact-checked, right? So you make sure that...
And always fact-check, yes.
Yeah.
Because, and also if you use just a general language model for like looking up facts, then use the search function, because both Perplexity has this, ChatGPT has this now. I think most of them have it by now, where they actually give actual sources. And in the beginning when they started this, often the links didn't work. Now it's quite rare that I see a link that doesn't work or is not relevant at all. Can happen, but that's why you always click the link and check where does this come from. But you got the distilled version first.
You always verify your own sources.
Always,
right?
Verify, yes.
Yeah.
Do you know, I have a question actually, do you know if it still hallucinates for large chunks of text? Because it used to do that, right? When there was so much text that it just started struggling with the memory.
It has the context window problem, right? Mm. So if you give it a really big amount of text, many pages, depending on which model and so on, but many of them will often have problems exactly keeping track of everything in there.
So often it's good to...
Yeah, and there are some studies that show that it tends to be sort of just before the around the middle, that it can't really remember everything. Often it's good at the start and the end and so on. So... somewhere in the middle, there will be
maybe
gaps.
That's much like humans.
Very much. So they do these needle in a haystack tests where they put some weird fact inside a huge text and see if it can remember
pinpoint
what was
that.
What did that guy have for dinner or whatever. And they're quite good at that, but still putting in the many different needles in the haystack of the text and say, find all the things he had for dinner throughout the whole book or whatever. It's still quite, I think, difficult.
It's going to have some trouble doing that.
Yeah.
Well, what's one thing you're most excited about and one thing that worries you regarding the future of AI and archaeology? I mean, we've had a bit of both already, but maybe if you each share one of these.
I think what I find exciting is definitely the identification of new sites. I think that is maybe one of the most promising thing. But something that worries me, I'm not sure. I think maybe just the confusion about the sources, just everybody not trusting anything anymore. Yeah, maybe the just general fear that there is around these tools because there is a lack of understanding.
Yeah.
I think that is a bit, I can see a lot of traditional archaeologists that are very scared of AI, right?
Mm.
So maybe that would be the negative aspect.
And also the other way around, if you just blindly
trust
it, right?
Yes, absolutely.
So I think finding that, I call it surgical criticism. So if you can be generally critical, that's very easy. It's not really, it's not hard to be critical of something, which many are. But if you know exactly why you're critical and exactly what you're critical about and where the pitfalls lie, especially, I think that you have a much better understanding and a much better grasp of things. I think that if I should answer that question as well, I'm really, really happy or like hopeful for the people being able to expand their view and the disciplinary view. I come from another discipline as well. So that's also, I have met many archaeologists and also in other fields through time, which only know their own discipline. And they are kind of very critical or skeptical about any other discipline. And here they can actually look things up in and understand really easily something that they did not understand before. So even if they are still critical, they will become more surgically critical, right? And they can learn many, many new things themselves as well. If you want to build something, if you want to build an app that does something that you really need that didn't exist before, you can do it yourself now, at least within reason, of course. Or if you want to learn a new method, you can learn it extremely quickly because normally before there would be that barrier. Okay, the learning curve is super steep, and now it can really help you break down that wall and understand pretty much anything, which I think is insane. But I think, as you also said, the misinformation generally from AI. I see a lot of, on social media, also a lot of AI images of things that look like a grave, for example, and then some story about it. Sometimes it's totally bullshit and people share it everywhere, and it can be more and more difficult to see what's real and what's not with the images and video and so on now. I think that's a huge problem,
I agree. I really agree. I think the image thing, especially because at a certain level of knowledge, you learn to distinguish between what's real and what's fake. And you're sort of always updated on how to tell these things apart. But as soon as you're outside this circle of internal knowledge and everyone knows that what's right and what's not right, then there's a whole world of people who just really just blindly believe most everything they see.
Yeah.
And these people have so many responsibilities in the world, right? Like they're not 80 plus sitting in a retirement home. They're like 45 and maybe in a government position or something like that, right?
Yeah.
So it's dangerous the way we don't keep training ourselves to be critical, because critical thinking is like a muscle you have to keep training, right?
Definitely.
Yeah.
And still, even as archaeologists, it can be difficult for us to now see images of some grave and really know if it looks so real, it's photorealistic now.
Mm.
So we wouldn't know if that specific grave is real or not. You just have to look it up and check the image, see if you can find it elsewhere in a reputable source.
But on a maybe more positive note, I do think things will also settle down. They say things are going very fast and it just keeps... But usually with technology, things eventually settle down and there are more regulations put into place and people are more trained on the subject. So hopefully there will be just more training about being critical about sources and AI and all these things. So I'm hopeful about that.
Yeah, I hope so too. Like people learn to use the internet at some point.
Yeah.
So hopefully they will also learn to use AI. I guess not everybody learns to use the internet.
Maybe that's why
we have the problems we have in the world today. I don't know.
No, but it is interesting though, this sort of idea that at every technological advance, there have been people who have been really for it and really against it. I mean, I imagine that even when they invented clay tablets, someone was like, no, the kids won't remember how to sing and read anymore. But now they'll just be writing it on clay. So you know, this is maybe just a human instinct and sort of an aversion to change, really.
I think
actually
many things we know about Celtic is written down by Romans or other groups, because they didn't, many of them at least, didn't want to learn writing. They were supposed to be memorized everything. So that's actually a really good example of where new technology is not adopted by a specific group. Yeah.
And what will sort of come of that, right?
Yeah.
And we do really live in interesting times, and we're both trying to define what AI is and trying to regulate it, while it's also simultaneously evolving more and more each day. But I think we can agree that it is becoming a part of the academic condition, right? And so my final question to you is if you can each share a rule of thumb when working with AI tools, whether that be on a student level like myself or as a researcher or professional, to just sort of be better in working with AI.
I would say to always remember AI is a tool. I think there's a tendency to think that AI can do everything. It really can't. So that it is a tool with advantages and disadvantages. the disadvantages, we haven't talked that much about sustainability, but that is really something to remember, that it is very often very unsustainable. And there are many advantages, but I would, just as like a general idea, I would say that you should always think of what is the project first and not just want to use AI for everything and adapt AI to the project. That would be maybe my end idea.
Yeah. And I think as a student, for example, just don't get it to write your assignments or whatever,
yeah,
because you are missing out on all the good learning doing that. I personally think it's fine to use it in the process, but use it to learn. So you internalize all the things that come out of this process and use it for sparring and all that. But check the sources, check everything that comes out of it and use your voice, because when you write, that is your voice. And it's extremely important. And if you let it write for you, you lose your voice.
Mm, yeah. Thank you for these insights. I think it's really valuable for our listeners to learn these things as AI is becoming more and more a part of our world. And before we fully wrap up, I'd love it if you guys could each do a quick summary of what we've talked about. What should be some of the key takeaways that our listeners should take with them from this episode? Maybe just one thing each.
Yeah? Oh, wow.
Should I start then?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think one thing is AI is not going away. It's here to stay. So learn to live with that existence and that world where it is here, and learn about it. Even if you don't like it, then it's better to learn why and what you don't like about it and be specific and so on about that. And use it to learn, but also check everything.
Yeah, inform yourself as much as you can.
And to summarize everything, I don't know, it's probably an AI for that, but
we'll ask ChatGPT to do it. Let's do that.
But overall, yeah, it's taking more and more. I think that's what we can summarize from this. Yeah. It's growing exponentially fast in both its abilities and its use cases.
Yeah, I think the overall thing is to embrace it, but not uncritically.
Yes.
Right? And don't get paralyzed, because there's this tendency of being paralyzed and not wanting to do anything. But maybe be hopeful about the future, about regulating AI, talking about it, informing yourselves about it. Yeah. That can be a positive outcome.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And I think staying hopeful is probably the best way to go on after this episode. And I think it's a great way to wrap it up. Rebecca, Miguel, thank you so much for joining today's episode. It's been wonderful having you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you, dear listener, for tuning in to this episode of Let's Dig Deeper. I hope you've learned lots and that you feel ready to submit to our coming robot overlords. Joking, of course. And if you have any questions or suggestions for the podcast, you can reach us at letsdigdeeperpodcast@gmail.com. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. I am Zinat Haroon and I've been your host. You can reach me on Instagram at @z_archaeology. Thanks for tuning in. I'll see you next time, where we will dig deeper into another topic. Bye.